Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 93. Dreaming as a Bridge Between Science and Religion. May 23rd, 2007. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
There's this sense that dreaming gives us kind of this special window into the realm of death and dying. And what my mom and I have done in this book is tried to provide people with a very, you know, sort of non-theoretical, and we're really not saying, oh, you know, Freud's right or Jung's right or neuroscientists are right. We're really just saying, look, when people are facing the final weeks and days and hours of their lives, they often find themselves confronting the most profound existential questions of human life. You know, what is the meaning of my individual life? What's going to happen to me now? And in response to those kinds of questions, people often experience powerful dreams and visions.
Powerful dreams and visions, indeed. That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Kelly Bulkeley. Kelly Bulkeley, Ph.D., is a visiting scholar at the Graduate Theological Union, and he teaches in the Dream Studies program at John F. Kennedy University. Both are in the San Francisco Bay Area. He earned his doctorate in religion and psychological studies from the University of Chicago Divinity School and is a former president of the International Association for the Study of Dreams. He has written and edited several books on dreaming, religion, psychology, culture, and science, including The Wilderness of Dreams, An Introduction to the Psychology of Dreaming, Visions of the Night, The Wandering Brain, Dreaming Beyond Death, and Soul, Psyche, Brain, New Directions in the Study of Religion and Brain-Mind Science. For some reason, there was an unusually large amount of static and background noise on the Skype call for this particular interview. I've done my best to filter it out, and hopefully it won't be too troubling. Now here's the interview. Dr. Kelly Bulkeley, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I see you have a background in divinity studies, first at Stanford, then Harvard, then the University of Chicago. Now, how did that come about?
Well, I've been interested in dreams since I was a teenager, thanks to some strange and perplexing nightmares of my own that piqued my curiosity and got me interested in exploring dreams and learning about what they mean. And the first place I turned was the study of psychology. I thought, well, psychology is how one art societies study dreams. But I pretty quickly found that the kinds of issues and themes and dimensions of dreams that I was interested in were not well covered by mainstream psychology. And I found myself in college and then in graduate school looking more and more to religious studies, to philosophy, to anthropology, comparative mythology, things like that, to teach me about sort of the broader dimensions of things, along with psychology. So I'm not a minister, I'm not a Bible something religious person per se. I'm passionately interested about dreams and studying them through a prism of religion and philosophy has been the way to found the most valuable to study them.
That's really fascinating because I think most people would think that psychology would be the doorway into studying dreams, either psychology or psychiatry, and I don't think it would have occurred to many people that ministry could be a good way to go.
Yeah, well the basic way I put it is that psychology as a discipline was founded in the mid-19th century, 150 or so years ago, and before that, people were talking about the dreams and thinking about their dreams and reflecting on them, but not in a psychological language, but usually in the languages of religion and philosophy and myth. And so if we really want to, this is my general argument in my research and writing, is that if we really want to understand the full spectrum of human dreaming and the full sort of potentiality of dreaming, we really have to look beyond psychology. And I'm not saying that psychology doesn't have a vital role, but we can't only rely on psychology. We really need to look at the collected wisdom of human cultures throughout history.
That's interesting. Of course, you and I both know Jeremy Taylor, who I've interviewed previously on this show, and he's a Unitarian Universalist minister and sees dream work as his ministry.
And yeah. Well, Jeremy is one of my closest friends and a true mentor. I still vividly remember going to meet him for the first time when I was a very green and naive graduate student, and he's been a guide and a real inspiration throughout my time in Sitting Dreams. And he's as a Unitarian minister, he finds dreaming to be an incredibly powerful means of opening people to their own spiritual potentials. And again, I'm not a minister, I'm not affiliated with any church or anything like that, but I work with ministers and with people in various faiths who look to dreams in that kind of way. And I think this is one of the truly universal themes of world religions, is a veneration for dreaming.
Yes.
For dreams as a way that humans can connect with and be guided by the divine, however they define that.
Yes. Now, not to beat this topic to death, but I couldn't help but notice on your website that your wife has Rev in front of her name, a reverend. So where does she tie into the...
Actually, I think you're referring to my mother.
Oh, really?
Patricia Balkley. Yeah, we co-authored Dreaming Beyond Death together.
Two
ago.
I was assuming that was your wife. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, that's fine. My wife's a lawyer, so does quite well for herself. But no, my mom is a Presbyterian minister, and again, you know, that's her calling, and she worked for 10+ years as a hospice chaplain, working with people who are on the verge of dying, and the various dreams and visions and pre-death spiritual experiences that she encountered in that work. She and I wrote the Dreaming Beyond Death book about that, as kind of a guide for what kinds of unusual dream and visionary experiences can happen around the time of death that the mainstream medicine really doesn't pay a lot of attention to. So, yeah.
Well, let's go ahead and talk about that book, Dreaming Beyond Death, A Guide to Pre-Death Dreams and Visions. So tell us some more about that, you know, what that book explores and so on.
Dreaming has always had an intimate connection in people's minds with death. I mean, there's in virtually every religious tradition, there's a sense that one of the spiritual functions of dreams is to give us a glimpse of what lies beyond this life. And, there's a folk belief that when we go to sleep and dream, our spirit or our soul is released. And when we wake up, our spirit or soul comes back. And if we die, our spirit or soul is released for good. And so there's this sense that dreaming gives us kind of this special window into the realm of death and dying. And what my mom and I have done in this book is tried to provide people with a very, you know, sort of non-theoretical, and we're really not saying, oh, you know, Freud's right or Jung's right or neuroscientists are right. We're really just saying, look, when people are facing the final weeks and days and hours of their lives, they often find themselves confronting the most profound existential questions of human life. You know, what is the meaning of my individual life? What's going to happen to me now? And in response to those kinds of questions, people often experience powerful dreams and visions and different types of experiences that people have questions about, well, where did that come from, or, you know, is that a divine intervention, or is that just something inside the person's own head? And what we argue is that wherever these dreams and visions come from, their effect, their pragmatic, practical effect, is very often to diminish people's fear and distress at the approaching end of their life, and in fact to give them sort of a sense of courage and hopefulness and peace. And the main theme in the kinds of dreams that we look at tends to be a theme of a journey. And you know, sort of big surprise, if you know anything about sort of world mythology and world religions, you know that death is often portrayed as a journey to some other land or some other realm or some other dimension of existence. And that often plays out in these people's dreams, where they will dream of being in a car, or they'll dream of being on a boat, or they'll dream of being on a train, or they're walking, or some sense of movement is very frequent in pre-death dreams and visions. And in our experience, it's a way of signaling that, yes, this is the ultimate and the final transition and transformation of human life. And it's something... Ultimately, I mean, even though some of the experiences are frightening and disgusting, many of them are not. And this is something we feel very, very strongly, that people should not be scared of these kinds of experiences, but celebrate them as part of, you know, sort of the natural spiritual wisdom of the human soul.
So I gather that in the process of writing this book, did you go out and actually collect a lot of dreams?
Oh yeah, that's just, and this is based on, you know, not only my research, but my mother's 10 plus years, you know, actually being with people. You know, she was a chaplain. She would be called in when people were, you know, they had a terminal diagnosis. They were going to die in a very short period of time. And she would help them talk through any concerns they had, help them plan the funeral, so lots and lots of, and it's the sort of thing that people have never really studied before, really investigated, in part because in Western medical context, there's often an assumption that, oh, if people start having, you know, strange dreams or visions, that must mean they're suffering dementia, you know, they're losing their mind, mm-hmm. They need to be medicated or something like that. So we really push back hard against that way of approaching death and see that. When you get that terminal diagnosis, it's not the end of life right there. It's the beginning of the final chapter of life. And that final chapter can be filled with discovery and with spiritual insight and with all sorts of transformations that these dreams and visions are part of.
That's interesting. And you talk about the Western perspective. I'm sure you've also looked into Tibetan Buddhism. And
sure. Yeah, well, we kind of, semi-jokingly thought of our book as kind of an American Book of the Dead. You know, it has its Book of the Dead, and, you know, the ancient Egyptians had a Book of the Dead, something that would provide people with some kind of guidance as they approach the end of this mortal life. We thought of this book, and we looked around, and my mom said that, you know, she did her work. She kept looking around for something she could provide to her patients and clients to help them understand what they were experiencing, and there just wasn't anything like it. So we tried to write something that it would be appropriate to this cultural context that would make sense for.
Yeah. Now, what is the Tibetan view? What would the Tibetan commentary on this be?
Well, the Tibetans, I mean, the view of death is that it's a transition from this incarnation to another one. And that if you can, as you're dying, maintain your awareness, mm-hmm. that you're dying and that this is, you know, part of a cycle of mortal existence. The goal, as I understand it, of the Tibetan process is to maintain a kind of clear awareness of what's happening so that you can be released from it. And most of the time people don't remember, and they're caught back up into the cycle of birth and death and rebirth. But for, I mean, nothing, very different, you know, ultimate theological views between, say, Christianity and Buddhism. But I think a similar approach to death, ultimately, in that it seems not as a something to fear or something to, you know, to avoid or to fight or to, you know, be terrified of, but rather sort of a, you know, tremendous opportunity for spiritual growth. And that, I think, is where Tibetans and Christians and people of many other faiths, I think, ultimately agree in the way they think about death.
Do you have any idea how Tibetans would regard these dreams, though?
Well, I would think that Tibetan and Buddhist tradition generally looks to dreams as expressions of our experiences in the waking world, the entanglements, the emotional conflicts, the habitual routines and patterns that we can sometimes get stuck in, and also perhaps as arenas in which sort of non-human, transpersonal, sometimes positive, sometimes negative forces can influence our lives. So I think that, again, I think that the similarities are quite strong in that Tibetans look at these dreams as indicators, as signs of where they're still stuck, and perhaps as glimpses of where they might move forward.
Okay. I'm remembering that Jung had a couple of very powerful dreams right near the end of his life. I'm thinking about that three-part film series that Lawrence Vanderpost narrates.
Yeah.
Do you remember that dream? Can you? I don't quite have it firmly.
I'm not going to have, like, I can't get the actual details. I'm looking up in the book here. I know we talked a bit about that. Yes, I mean, Jung is an inspiration, of course, to everybody who works with dreams, and his approach to perspective function of dreaming is really what we drew upon the most in this book. The idea that dreams have kind of an anticipatory function, or look ahead to what's coming in our lives.
Yes.
And at the end of life, that's the, you know, sort of the ultimate perspective challenge is what's going to come after physical death.
Right.
So that's really where we rely most heavily on you.
Yeah, I seem to recall that it was a dream. Maybe there was a tree and the roots were wrapped around gold. I could be making this up, though, but I just remember there was
and he had a profound near-death experience, of course, you know, and, as I recall it, he, you know, sort of the classic experience of being elevated out of his body and rising above the earth and then being pulled back with the realization that none still has things to do in this world.
No, I wasn't aware of that one.
Yeah, I remember that from somewhere in the Confronting the Unconscious chapter of Memory, Dreams, Reflections.
Oh, okay. It's been a long time since I read that one.
Yeah.
I'm sure it would probably be a good one to reread.
Yeah.
I know that this is taking off in a little bit of a different direction. I know that you've studied dreams in relation to political orientation. What can you tell us about that?
Sure. Well, that's been a kind of a sideline area of research for several years. The one that I'm curious about for a couple reasons. One, I've noticed just in pursuing my main area of research, which is the dream teachings and traditions of the world's religious group, that virtually every religious tradition looks to dreams as sources of insight, not only for personal well-being and guidance, but also for collective well-being and guidance. And so then looking at Western psychological teachings that really restrict the sphere of meaningfulness of dreams to the individual, to the intrapsychic, Jung is better on this than, say, Freud or some others, but for the most part, the trend, I think, in Western psychology tend to think of dreams as only about, your inner world business. And if you dream, for example, of the president, well, that's not really a dream about the president. That's about the president part of you.
Yeah.
And I had some questions about that. This goes back 16 years now when I first started studying this. And so since then, I've been looking at people's dreams of politicians. I've been looking at dreams around election time when there's sort of, in the United States, when there's a lot of political sort of energy and enthusiasm. And I've also been looking at comparisons of the dream, sleep and dream patterns of people who are politically liberal on the one hand and politically conservative on the other hand. So in various ways, trying to look at, what are the more collective dimensions of dreaming, and not, several times I have found people dreams of the president or President Clinton or President Bush or whomever, where it seems like, those themes are reflecting something about their personal lives.
Mm-hmm.
But there are plenty of times in findings that I'm coming up with that suggest that, dreaming really does reflect some broader realities as well, and that we shouldn't sell dreams short by thinking they only have value for individual life, but also for, our understanding of collective realities as well. So.
Well, for example, have you found any findings or preliminary findings in terms of differences between the dreams of liberals versus the dreams of conservatives?
Yeah, well, the main finding on that score, and I'm continuing with work research on that. I've got a book coming out next year on this subject, so I'll have a lot more to say about this soon. But the findings at this point seem to be that political conservatives, in this country anyway, tend to have dreams that are more grounded in waking reality, that tend to be more sort of dealing with everyday experiences, sort of the here and now of life. And liberals, by contrast, tend to have dreams with more bizarre things happening, more flying, more dead people coming back to life, more sort of fantasy material. I hear you chuckling. And this is where, I'm reluctant to even sometimes talk about this stuff because it leads so easily into some partisan stereotypes.
It fits so well into stereotypes, that conservatives would describe themselves as down to earth and realistic, and those liberals are flighty and just, full of dreams that are totally unreal and unrealistic.
Yeah. Well, and you can also think that, and I've had people respond this way, that, conservatives are more, uptight and constricted and limited, and liberals are more creative and more expansive and more imaginative, so it sort of depends on your point of view. And again, this is sort of early stages of this research, even still, as much as I've done, and I'm hoping to kind of expand it so I can kind of push it beyond this sort of easy stereotype and see what, because my own sense is that the American body politic, we have many different voices, and each voice has its sort of distinctive strengths and perhaps its distinctive drawbacks.
Mm-hmm.
And my strong belief about dreams is that dreams are honest portrayals of who we are. Warts and all, our best strengths and virtues, and our worst failings, and trying to apply that to contemporary politics seems to me like, wow, we could use all the help we could get in trying to sort through some of the issues we're facing, the conflicts that are slowing us down. And so I have a real faith in planting some dream seeds out in the world, and think about that. What are the ultimate values that bind conservatives and bind liberals, and what do they share? I found that during the administration of Bill Clinton, the studies I was doing, I was hearing more nightmares from conservatives. And in recent years, since the presidency of George Bush, I've heard a lot more nightmares from liberals. So, you know, there might be some sense that we, you know, we're sensitive to, you know, the dangers that we perceive from the other party, such that, you know, that can affect us in our dreams.
That's interesting. That's interesting. I think I really like the kind of sophisticated considerations that you're bringing to bear on this. At the same time, I wonder if you might not be a little apprehensive about whether or not this book will be caricatured in reviews and might become a target for, you know, political whatever.
Oh, sure. Well, that's already happened. I've done different studies over the years that have generated various kinds of responses, and I'm not worried. I just do what I feel I need to do. This forthcoming book, I think, is going to take it in a direction that hopefully will generate a little more respect, if nothing else. And how I'm approaching it is, I have the core of this book is going to be called American Dreamers, and the core is going to be 10 people who over the past year kept a detailed sleep and dream journal. And these are people from different political backgrounds, liberals and conservatives, they're from different parts of the country, different ages. I'm thinking of them as kind of a dreamer's focus group. And this is going to give, along with sort of the bigger survey data that I have, this is going to give kind of a real, you know, in-depth, detailed, personal level view of actual Americans and their actual dreams and dream patterns. And these are not all people who have any particular interest in dreams. They're just normal people, and for the most part. And I'm hoping that by sort of grounding my discussion at that level, just telling these people's stories and looking at how their dreams and their nightmares are woven into their waking lives, and into their waking life political beliefs, that we'll get a richer understanding of that kind of, you know, sort of the political unconscious, I guess, is what I'm ultimately trying to illuminate. And I'm hoping that by, grounding that analysis in the, you know, really, I think, compelling personal life narrative, that'll get people to pay a little more attention, and not just our, you know, being silly about, you know, oh, liberals are dumb or conservatives are dumb.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like it's going to be a fascinating book. And
working away on it, I'll let you know.
Now, speaking of the political unconscious, did you do any writing about the dreams of Osama bin Laden and or his followers?
Yeah. There's the video that came out, I believe, in December of 2001, soon after the terrorist attack of September 11th, in which Osama bin Laden spent quite a bit of time talking with his followers about the dreams that people were having about the upcoming attack. And what I found most, and I have written some about this, but the way that he thought that people, he told people to stop talking about their dreams, because he thought that the dreams were going to sort of give away the secret of what they were planning. And Islam, I mean, this is another project I'm working on. I'm co-editing a book with a couple of colleagues on dreams in Christianity and Islam, specifically to try to generate some dialogue and conversation between these two traditions.
Good.
And what I've learned from my Muslim colleagues is that dreaming is enormously important in Muslim culture. Mm-hmm. Always has been and continues to be right into the present day. In many ways, more central and sort of openly acknowledged than in Christian cultures and communities. So the fact that Muhammad, Osama bin Laden, and Saddam Hussein, and
Gaddafi,
Taliban leader in Afghanistan, there's reports of all these people talking about the dreams. And again, I think if, you know, putting it strictly in terms of, you know, we need to understand better the dynamics and the motivations and the you know, behaviors of people in the Muslim world, if that's really our goal, and I think everybody agrees with that, we really need to understand their dreams as well and how they think about dreams. So that's a huge part of Islamic culture.
I believe that your currently latest book, and it seems like you're moving fast as a writer, so that's always going to be a moving target, but you've got a fairly recent book out called The Wondering Brain, Thinking About Religion With and Beyond Cognitive Neuroscience. So what does that mean, thinking about religion with and beyond cognitive neuroscience?
Yeah, well, this project grew out of my dream research, and the last 10 or 15 years has been a very exciting time in the neuroscientific study of sleep and dreaming, in the sense that now we've got these wonderful new brain imaging toys that can sort of, you know, poke around inside the brain and give us images of different levels of chemical and electrical activity during sleep and presumably during dreaming. And what I found was that oftentimes these results, these scientific results, were used to sort of beat up on dreams and say, ah, now we know that it's all just the brain and it doesn't really mean anything. And then I started noticing that many of these same authors, or authors sort of in the same arena, were making the same basic argument about religion. That, now that we can look inside the brain, we can see that, oh, it's, you know, people's belief in God or their religious experience or their vision, that's not really, you know, something outside of them. That's just the brain. And so there's been some real tension between those who study things like dreams and religion and mythology and those who are in the neuroscientific realm. And, as I began to really look into that the neuroscientific literature, I found one, you know, they're just wrong in some of their arguments about religion and dreams. There's just the understanding of what dreaming is, understanding of what religion is among many neuroscientists is very inadequate, shall we say. But at the same time, and this is where, you know, this is my hopefulness coming through, I find a lot of fascinating insights in the neuroscientific literature that I think if we read them not with the kind of materialist biases of the scientists themselves, but if we just look at their findings, and if we look at the research, and if we look broadly at different discoveries that are being made, we realize, wow, there's actually a lot that we can learn about the power of dreaming, the power of spirituality and religion and human life, the power of sort of human creativity and imagination that goes far beyond what, like I said, materialist scientists are themselves seeing in the data that they're producing in their research studies. So I'm kind of trying to draw together the studies of religion and dreams and visions and creativity and put it together with some of the new neuroscientific research in a way that, like the title suggests, goes beyond what I perceive to be the limits of, you know, someone like Richard Dawkins and the God delusion. I think that's just a failure of imagination to see what the new scientific findings are actually teaching us.
Can you give an example of one of these scientific findings that might lead some to a materialistic conclusion, but leads you to say, wow, look at the power of dreaming?
Sure. Well, the main one I find so interesting is the way that in dreaming, the part of the brain that's responsible for what's called secondary visual processing becomes very active. And that's the part of the brain that, if I ask you to, you know, close your eyes and imagine yourself on a, you know, beautiful beach and the waves are crashing and the sun is shining above you, you're not seeing that with your primary visual sense, with your eyes. You're imagining it. You are recreating within your mind. There's a quite a significant part of the brain-mind system devoted to that. No big surprise, when we dream, that part of the brain becomes extremely active. And what that suggests to me, and in connection with a high degree of activation of what's called the amygdala and the limbic system, which is responsible for instinctual behavior or strong emotions, and so forth. And what that suggests to me is that dreaming is, first off, it's healthy, normal. It's not like you're some deluded, your brain is malfunctioning or something. No, it's a different way in which the brain is functioning. And what it says to me is that humans are natural visionaries, that we have within us this powerful visionary capacity that's autonomous from ego control. When I ask you to imagine something, you know, in the waking state, that's kind of a top-down, we set the imagination process in motion. But dreaming is autonomous. Dreaming is spontaneous. Dreaming comes from non-volitional, non-ego sources. And to me, that really supports the various reports and experiences people have described through history of spontaneous visions and spontaneous dreams that seem to come from nowhere.
Yes.
And yet have these profound revelations and insights that come with them. And to me, the new neuroscientific research is showing, yes, we have that capacity. Now, we're always going to debate, well, is that all it is? Are there gods or divine beings beyond that? And for the moment, I kind of bracket those questions down. What I focus on is, let's look at what amazing potentials there are within the human brain-mind system and how perfectly they account for and help us understand the variety and the spectacular power of human dreams and visions through history. And I don't see that as a kind of a weapon or a club to like beat on spiritual people and say, now you see it flowing from your brain. I see it as like, wow, we are just beginning to grasp the profound depth of human potential. And these research studies, these neuroscientific studies, I think in many ways are confirming things that we've learned through religion and spirituality over the ages.
Yes, yes. Do you think there are things that people can do to cultivate that visionary power?
Sure. Well, that's the great question. That's a natural follow-up question. And in the study of dreams, that's often sort of explored under the heading of dream incubation, right? That the various ritual practices to enhance the potential to have a powerful revelatory dream or something. And I think that some of the common themes in these practices, and we can look at everything from Tibetan Buddhism and different yogic practices of Naropa and Milarepa and people like that, to the temples of Asclepius in ancient Greece and throughout the Mediterranean, to Native American vision quests. Islam has a practice called Sitakara, which is their kind of version of dream incubation. I mean, there's virtually every culture tries this because there's a sense, wow, if we could encourage and stimulate this, these kinds of experiences, it would really be a benefit. And I'd say, this is very general, of course, but some of the basic themes of these ritual practices are trying to separate the individual from sort of ordinary, profane, human, earthly life, and coming closer to whatever it is the individual considers to be the divine or the sacred or those kinds of energies. So trying to separate from this world by means of bathing, fasting, wearing, taking off your clothes, wearing special clothes, and usually sleeping in a special place. Not in your regular bed, but, in a graveyard, in a cave, on a mountaintop, by a sacred fire or sacred hearth, in a temple. These are all, in all these different traditions, various ways of trying to, separate oneself from the ordinary world and bringing oneself as close as you can to the realm where you believe these powers dwell. And in almost every tradition, there's a recognition that it might not work. You know, I mean, all you can do is sort of put yourself out there and open yourself up, and then maybe a dream will come, and maybe a dream won't come. It's not. I don't know of any tradition that considers this sort of an automatic, you know, mechanical process. If you do X, Y, and Z, and bing, there you got your dream revelation. It's more, you open yourself, you prepare yourself, you invite the dream creating power to come, and then you see what happens.
Yeah, yeah. Given the amount of conscious mind attention that you focused on this whole area of dreaming, I'm wondering if it's had any impact on your personal dream life.
Well, sure. I mean, one thing we know from basic dream research is that we dream about that which we care about and, you know, are concerned about in our waking lives. So, you know, for example, I dream more about my wife, I think, than any other character. She's the most important person in my waking world, and she appears most in my dreaming world as well. I think my dreams, I mentioned at the outset, the nightmares that sort of plagued me early in adolescence and that kind of propelled me along this path, and those have definitely changed. I mean, the kinds of conflicts and tensions that I was experiencing then through, you know, my trying to understand those dreams, they have changed, and I feel like I've grown in that process. Now, one of the things that I one of the ways that I relate with my dreams is as a source of new ideas and insight. And so, you know, if I have a dream, I mean, the dreams in politics subject is a good example. I mean, it's not like I set out to study that, but I had a couple dreams of, you know, being with my dad and with Ronald Reagan, with Republicans. And my dad, very conservative, he was a Reagan supporter back then, and I'm not. I'm very different from him. And those dreams and the way my family relationship was intertwined with the political theme got me thinking. It's like, wow, I wonder if anybody else had dreams like that. And so that's the way my dreams are, you know, sort of a resource for me, that they kind of give me ideas about what's out there, and then I go and explore. And sometimes I find other people do have dreams like that, and sometimes I find they don't. I don't think my dreams are sort of the gold standard by any means, you know, that, oh, I have the right kinds of dreams, the best kinds of dreams, but I know my dreams pretty well, and when I learn something from them, it makes me wonder if other people were, you know, experiencing that as well.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I try to keep kind of just an open conversation going and see where it leads.
Excellent. I noticed on your website that you have a dream survey that you're actually inviting anybody who comes to your website to fill out. And I guess that provides you with a lot of great raw material for future books, huh?
Yeah, well, that's in my website's in, you know, I guess websites are always in the process of being refurbished and redone, and I'm just about to give a sort of whole new orientation for it. But yes, that survey I've had up for a while, and I mean, there's always an issue, not just with internet surveys, but, you know, surveys with college students or, you know, anywhere, that you never know if people aren't just kind of making it up, you know, and that's kind of a challenge for research in this area. And so with the surveys that I receive over the internet, I for the most part, I take people at, you know, at their word.
And, sure.
What I look for, and this has become more and more my sort of research MO, is that I try not to base any claim or any argument on a single case, because you just never know. You know, you just never know if someone, you know, they sort of fabricated it, or they maybe polished it up a little bit. What I'm interested in at this point, in large part, is trying to find some of these broad, very, very pervasive themes and patterns that, whether or not, you know, a few people are kind of pulling my leg, you start to see the same kind of pattern. For example, this pattern of conservatives having more sort of realistic type dreams and liberals having somewhat more bizarre dreams. Like, if I only heard that in a couple of dreams, a couple of people, I'd be like, eh, maybe. But when I start to see it, you know, over lots and lots of people, hundreds of people, then I start to think, yeah, maybe there's something going to that. So that internet survey is part of a general, you know, just trying to hear about people's dreams and, you know, people from different backgrounds and different perspectives, and then see what we can learn.
Now, you're going to be a presenter at the upcoming 24th Annual International Association for the Study of Dreams Conference in Rohnert Park. What are you presenting on?
Well, actually, this is a different kind of angle and title, but I'm going to be helping, doing something with my mother, the Dream Beyond Death book and the teaching that we've done out of that. I'm also going to be doing a presentation on a homeless program in San Francisco, where a Catholic church, has allowed for the last couple of years, homeless people to sleep in the pews during the day, where you know, people who aren't able to make use of shelters at night and are terribly sleep deprived and are in various kinds of distress and danger are allowed to sleep in this church. And what strikes me about it is it's kind of an unintentional incubation site for people who are in obviously very desperate circumstances. And so I visited the church and talked to some people there, and I'm hoping, I've still got a little work to do to get it ready for the conference, but my hope is to illuminate for people who are interested in dreams another area in which I think we can contribute to sort of collective well-being and betterment, because these people are obviously in very difficult circumstances. And it seems to me everything we know about sleep and dreams is that if people aren't getting an opportunity to sleep, if people aren't getting the simple opportunity to rest and to allow their creative imagination to be free as they are in our dreams, how do we possibly expect them to function well in the waking world? And so this particular program at the church in San Francisco, I think, is a very thought-provoking example for those of us in the dream studies world about how we might promote certain kinds of social reform, cultural change that can, just at a very basic level, enhance people's ability to sleep well and dream well.
Well, that certainly sounds fascinating. Well, Dr. Kelly Bulk, did I cut you off? Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
I look forward to meeting you at the conference.
Looking forward to it. I hope some of your listeners should come along too. It's a lot of fun.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Dr. Kelly Bulkley. And I hope that the background noise wasn't too distracting. I have to say I'm really impressed by Kelly's prolific ability to keep spinning off new ideas for research on dreams and for writing. Many years ago, I was actually approached myself by a publisher who urged me to write a book on dreams. And my response at the time was that I didn't know what to write and that there were already so many books out there on dreams that I wasn't sure there was anything new to say. And of course, since that time, there have been hundreds of new books written on the topic of dreams. So unfortunately, that's a way that I have blocked myself in the past. And so don't use that excuse if you're thinking of writing a book. The fact that other people have already written books on the topic, there will continue to be books coming out anyway, and that's a lesson that I've learned late. So I have to say I'm very much in awe of Kelly and these other dream pioneers who I've been interviewing and who have written many of the recent books and continue to do so. I thought you might be interested for me to read to you the IASD, that's the International Association for the Study of Dreams, their code of ethics. Kelly has a copy of that on his website, and I thought it might interest you since I've been promoting the Dream Conference so much. And this organization, which, by the way, you're all welcome to join, it's an interesting organization in as much as lay people and scientists and practitioners all can join and all can participate and intermingle with one another. And they really have a nice set of guidelines that they've developed on their website. Let me read those to you. I've taken this off of Kelly's website, but I'm sure it's also on the IASD website. IASD Dreamwork Ethics Statement. IASD celebrates the many benefits of dreamwork, yet recognizes that there are potential risks. IASD supports an approach to dreamwork and dream sharing that respects the dreamer's dignity and integrity, and which recognizes the dreamer as the decision maker regarding the significance of the dream. Systems of dreamwork that assign authority or knowledge of the dream's meanings to someone other than the dreamer can be misleading, incorrect, and harmful. Ethical dreamwork helps the dreamer work with his/her own dream images, feelings, and associations, and guides the dreamer to more fully experience, appreciate, and understand the dream. Every dream may have multiple meanings, and different techniques may be reasonably employed to touch these multiple layers of significance. A dreamer's decision to share or discontinue sharing a dream should always be respected and honored. The dreamer should be forewarned that unexpected issues or emotions may arise in the course of the dream work. Information and mutual agreement about the degree of privacy and confidentiality are essential ingredients in creating a safe atmosphere for dream sharing. Dream work outside a clinical setting is not a substitute for psychotherapy or other professional treatment and should not be used as such. IASD recognizes and respects that there are many valid and time-honored dream work traditions. We invite and welcome the participation of dreamers from all cultures. There are social, cultural, and transpersonal aspects to dream experience. In this statement, we do not mean to imply that the only valid approach to dream work focuses on the dreamer's personal life. Our purpose is to honor and respect the person of the dreamer as well as the dream itself, regardless of how the relationship between the two may be understood. And there's a credit here. It says, prepared by Carol Warner, International Association for the Study of Dreams, Spring 1997. So this ethical statement was formulated 10 years ago, and it seems like a rather sensible approach to me. If you're interested in attending the IASD conference that's coming up June 29 through July 3rd in Rohnert Park, California, just north of San Francisco, you can find the complete details on the IASD website at www.asdreams.org.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
Okay, well, here we are at episode number 93. And I'm hoping you'll send me an audio clip I can use on show number 100, which is coming up soon. Also, remember that I've said I'll send someone a copy of the book Warriors, Settlers, and Nomads by hypnotherapist Terrence Watts for the best audio transition received before the end of this month of May 2007. So for either the 100th show, celebration, or a transition, please just send me a short voice clip. You can send an MP3 file to shrink at shrinkwrapradio.com, or you can click on the My Chingo button on our website and record it there, or you can leave a voice message for ShrinkPod on Skype, or finally, you can leave me a message on our phone line at 206-337-0622. Now we've got two new additions to our Frapper map, so a big thank you and a welcome to Tom Barbalay in Las Vegas, Nevada, who says, it's a luxury to hear your podcast. Keep up the great work. Well, it's a luxury to have listeners like you and to get comments like that, I must say. And then to hear from Becca in Wuhan, China, who sent what looks like her graduation picture in front of what might be a Chinese temple or some kind of special building. And she says, I am here. So, Becca, if you're a recent grad, congratulations, and thanks so much for listening to Shrink Wrap Radio. And if you're not on our Frapper map, you can put yourself there. There's a place on our Shrink Wrap Radio website where you can link to the map. On another note, I accidentally put a wrong number in the feed for show number 91, and it kind of threw off the data so that iTunes listed it as taking 450 hours, which caused some people some problems, and it may have affected show 92. I haven't figured that out yet. So hopefully it's all worked out now, and I'll try to be more careful about these little details in the future. As usual, the sponsors for this show are Podshow and GoDaddy. Remember to use the code SHRINK3 at checkout from GoDaddy to get a discount on your next domain name or web hosting purchase there.
This is Josh C. from San Jose. You're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thanks, Josh, for that transition. There are no emails that have come in since the last show. We're playing them in such close succession here. Thanks again to Dr. Kelly Bulkeley for the opportunity to interview him on dreams as a bridge between science and religion. I hope you're enjoying this series on different approaches to dream work. Our next show, in fact, will be with Dr. Alan Siegel on the wisdom of the dream. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.